Ladies and gentlemen, please welcome back our moderator and panelists.
Okay. Thank you very much. We're now going to move on. We have a number of your questions that have been given to us. We've gone through them, and they're just a bunch of terrific questions. So we're each going to tackle one of them and solve them in the next few minutes. One question is, does the approach to post-conflict development need to be different from development in general? And Donald, I wonder if you could tackle that. And you know, one post-conflict situation we may see pretty soon, frankly, is Zimbabwe. I mean, I wonder how, for example, in that case in particular, the issues of post-conflict development will be different from development in general.
How much time do I have? 7 minutes.
You have about a minute and a half or 2 minutes to solve the problem.
Solve that.
First of all, to say that we have to be humble to say that we don't know enough about what is it that makes development. We're learning every day. Each country is different. Starting points are different. The conditions are different. And no one today knows what is it that spurs development in some parts of the world. Not elsewhere. Now, if we know little about normal steady-state countries, it follows that we know even less how to rebuild fractured societies. And therefore, in so doing, it has to be very much country-specific. And as our colleague said, we have to go in there prepared to help, but not to proffer lessons. Because far too often, international organizations or bilateral organizations, we move in with lessons, with templates, and we do damage. Now, we have now in the OECD the so-called principles of re-engagement in fractured societies, and I think it is important to try and stay within that architecture. Let me give you one example. We have in the bank, given that many of these countries are African, since a year ago established what you call a fragile state facility. And I had to answer this question, what is so special about these countries, Liberia, the Congo, Burundi, and the rest of it? First thing is that the few people who are educated, who are capable, have gone away. In the case of Zimbabwe, which you mentioned, they have gone to South Africa. So there is no capacity. Second, institutional memory has been completely lost. And third, confidence has been lost. And I'll find the confidence, not in the classic sense, business confidence, confidence between communities, confidence between the communities and the states, and that has to be rebuilt. And therefore, it presents a set of challenges which are different from a steady-state country. Yeah, just referring to my own country, which I know better. After the genocide in Rwanda, the verdict was, this is another basket case. It will never come back. So a bit of humanitarian aid here, a bit of support here, but the verdict was here another African country gone to the basket. So that was the verdict. Now, we as Rwandans have to prove, wait a minute, this is our country, we're here, we have to rebuild it. And we had to invent how to do things, including how to provide justice when you have got a million people who have been killed. It cannot be the same as a steady-state country.
Thank you. Mayu, one person asked, in Rwanda or El Salvador, were there specific programs to help people return to their land? And since you have a full minute and a half, maybe with that much time, you can also address land reform.
Whoever did that question, that was basic and fundamental. Because people wanted to feel that they were in their country. They didn't want to migrate. But the problem was not only giving them the land. They needed a house when they went back into that land. So then you have land tenancy program together with a housing program, which brought you that you need a road to get back there and that you need to reinstall electricity together with water and with the sewage. And then the kids need education and health. So again, you're rebuilding a small town. So yes, that is definite. If not, people will not feel that they have been, and the reconciliation process will not be closed. That was a very fundamental issue in the wake of conflict.
Thank you. Peter, one person asks, how do countries best cope with psychosocial counseling and other needs in post-conflict countries, especially when a large percentage of the population of its women and girls have been subjected to rape? And considering Liberia in particular,
how
would you address that?
Well, first I'd say the rape doesn't stop, and so it's much deeper than just psychosocial counseling. We are working with the IRC on a big project around what's often called gender-based violence. I call it violence against women. That's what it is. And we have to work with governments. We have to work with law enforcement. We have to, you know, to change laws and then to make sure people get prosecuted, to make sure women feel safe to report them, clinics, right down to safe spaces for girls. It's so complex, and it has to be so vertical to make sure whatever you're doing sticks and works. You know, girls are the first tool of war, and they're the last tool of stability. And the former has to stop, and the latter has to be the primary agent of change, actually. So, you know, there's a lot of work to be done, but you've got to stop, you know, you just stop rape everywhere it happens. And so you've got to also work with the men and boys to make sure that social norms or acceptable behaviors also changed. I mean, it's complicated. And that's the other part about all of this work is there is no easy answer. And there is always a problem underneath the problem you thought you were solving. And so you've got to keep committed and looking and listening to solve any of these things. And you know, rape just should never happen again. And we got to figure out how to do that on every level, from government on down to the individual, that it's happening.
Thank you. And now to discuss the themes from the table conversations, I'd like to introduce Jane Wales.
Thank you so much. Several really excellent themes emerged, which are being right now shared with the panel. The first is to promote training for job skills so people can become self-sufficient. The second is to develop a mechanism to coordinate post-conflict actors, NGOs, foreign assistance, government investment, private sector, philanthropic investment. And this speaks a lot to an earlier commitment we heard on Liberia in one of the first plenaries where there was a choice to come together and collaborate and coordinate. The third is it speaks to child soldiers, and that's the question of how to integrate not just child soldiers but also adults, integrate former combatants into civil society. The next is to prioritize investment that demonstrates visible results so that the population has a sense that that progress is occurring, particularly in certain sectors such as public works, housing, et cetera. The next is to promote long-term planning that coincides with short-term stabilization. This might be an ending thought for the panel. And the next is to take steps to recreate trust, respect local leaders who are willing to bring national healing. And then the last is to encourage external private investment through favorable government policies and incentives. Now, here are the gems. We've got three. The first is that government should develop land ownership maps to reduce new conflict. Second is to create or rebuild independent media through foundation support. And the third is to use information technology to track incidents of violence to better predict conflict before it spreads. So I turn to you to comment on those.
Thank you, Jane. So now some instant analysis from the best team in development television here. Peter,
you know, these are great, and it's all, you know, everything here as a component of what we're trying to do, I'd like to think anyway. Certainly concrete and immediate results. One of the things we did while we were working with the IRC and others to do these kind of long-term big idea things that would last, hopefully forever, be taken up by the government or society, is to also support the Market Women's Fund. If you've seen Abby Disney's film, Pray the Devil Back to Hell, you will know that the women really got Liberia turned around. And if the, it's just like here, if the average person can't turn on their lights, they don't think things are really happening. So you've got to do both the long-term visionary sustainable planning and implementation, but you've also got to be there on the ground making sure that people know they can either get clean water or turn their lights on or do some of the basic stuff. That so hopefully the president will get reelected, because that's one of the key goals here, is to make sure she stays there long enough to get these things pushed through.
Thank you. And Mayu?
Yes, my thoughts would immediately take me into promoting and training for job skills so people can become self-sufficient. But I would give it a little twist. It's because of dignity. What people want at the end, they don't want to be receiving donations from someone. They want to be able to take control of their lives. So it's always the same saying, teach a person how to fish, you know, not give them the fish. It is true. But also, it's the possibility then that with that capacity, then you can go into the long-term planning, because at the end, what you need to resolve is that the conflict does not repeat itself because of the same injustices that had occurred. So with people and opportunities and the capacity to do it themselves with dignity and honesty, definitely you are cementing a country that will grow and stand on its own.
Donald?
Thank you. I would like to say these are great themes which I think go in the right direction. But I must say that conflict is invariably, most of the times, caused by bad government. When there is a good government, it's able to mediate conflicts, it's able to handle them in a non-confrontational way. Now, these are things which go into building that kind of government. And I think this is a great idea. One of them, which I like very much, is this idea of reintegrating combatants quickly. Because it is very easy. The cost of entry, as we say, to restarting conflict are very, very low. Very low. A few guns here and they go back to the bush. So reintegrating them to society quickly so they become part of this stakeholder system is great.
Yeah, that's where I just say things like vocational training are critical, because the other thing is you go to these countries and you see little children who will not remember or even know what happened. And if they end up 12, 13, 14, so you have to get them into school, but get the 15, 18-year-olds and beyond into some vocational training so everybody starts to integrate into society.
The last of the gems sure struck a chord with me, that use information technology to track incidents of violence to better predict conflict before it spreads. That, you know, in Chad and in Central African Republic, you drive through and you see these schools or clinics that have been built, and they have a nice sign saying donated by whatever, such and such a country. And they've been attacked by militias, and the teachers or doctors have been killed, and they've been burned. And you can't do anything as long as you have that kind of violence spreading. And as Peter said earlier, the prospect, once a civil war starts, there's a 50% chance it's going to revive. The average civil war in Africa has cost about $100 billion economic cost to itself and its neighbors. And I think there is pretty good evidence that if one acts early, if one has sort of early warning systems, that one can, at a dramatically lower cost, really intervene and provide and substantially reduce the prospect that that conflict is going to arise in the first place. And you look how little conflict in Liberia ends up spreading through Sierra Leone, through Ivory Coast, and so on. Same thing in Central Africa. And, yet we don't learn that lesson. It's not sexy, but I wish there were more instruments, more monitoring of potential conflict areas and an effort to really prevent these conflict areas from happening in the first place. So this panel at some point in the future is not going to be necessary at all. We actually have managed to solve all the problems of, you know, post-conflict, and we still have 2 minutes and 40 seconds left. So I wonder if, we've talked about successes. I wonder if there are any lessons that you have about efforts that people made that fall short, if there's some lessons we should learn from our failures in these post-conflict situations. I mean, we've sort of alluded to some of these, but...
There's a very tough one, and it's the amnesty. In a country like mine, where there was so much killing, the only way to bring, you know, everybody, combatants, back into civil society, you had to give an amnesty law. So there is always that thing, if did we do it right? Didn't we do it wrong? You know, where does justice come in? Or is that justice? You know, having the persons be able then. So that's always in the back of the mind, is did we do that right or not? But at the end, for me, it was right, because it was the only way that we could have everyone come back into the country with a clean slate. And you would have people who had, you know, their brothers, sisters murdered or kidnapped or whatever. And it really didn't matter where you were a combatant from the government, from the guerrillas, didn't matter. So those are tough situations in which you will always get people that will say, you should not have an amnesty law, you should have trials for everybody. But then on the other side you say, no, you need to rebuild trust and confidence. And for that you have to have a clean slate. That's a tough one for me.
Thank you. Now I'm delighted to introduce Jane again, who will discuss the commitments in this area.
I think next year we should have a whole panel on peace and justice, because then thank you, Mayu, for raising that really complicated issue. It's a really tough, it's a hard one. I now get to call some pretty remarkable people to the stage, starting with Amitabh Sandugi, who's CEO of the International Development Enterprises India. Thank you, Amitabh. IDE India has joined with the Skoll Foundation, the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundations, and several others to commit to disseminating low-cost irrigation technologies. This will involve micro-irrigation technologies. It will involve treadle pumps. It will regard a whole group of technologies that are appropriate to the situation. This is a $35 million commitment. The hope is to increase the income of 250,000 poor shareholder, small shareholder farmers. So if we could have the certificate. Thanks. Thank you so much. Next, Ambassador Alan Rock, if you come to the stage, from the Fund for War-Affected Children and Youth in Northern Uganda. This speaks to one of the issues that came up from the table. Thanks for joining us. This is a multi-donor initiative, yet again. It's to provide long-term financial support to educate and reintegrate war-affected children, youth, young women, while promoting peace and reconciliation in northern Uganda. This fund will provide more than 10,000 vulnerable young women who were abducted and forced to bear children by the army, provide them secondary school opportunities. It'll promote training and business skills as well, income-generating activities for more than 10,000 youth, and the hope is to reintegrate 22,000 former combatants. This was a partnership with the MacArthur Foundation, amongst others. It is a $25 million commitment over 10 years, and so please join me in applauding it. Now, let me just see. Esteban Matsesuma, who's the chairman of Fundación Azteca, would you please join us? Thank you, Esteban. This is a four-year, $100 million commitment to sustainable rural cities. It involves partners such as UNICEF and the state government. Its goal of this commitment is to improve social and economic opportunities in 232 rural communities. The first sustainable rural city will be built in 2008 with 400 new homes, and we hope we'll be looking forward to 25 such cities by 2012. So please join me in applauding it. Now I would like to introduce a progress report and say a quick goodbye to Peter, who has to catch the problem is we keep double booking people. It is entirely our fault that Peter has to rush off. But I would like to invite to the stage George Rupp. He's president and CEO of the International Rescue Committee, which we all have great respect. Where are you? There you are. So come on up.
Thank you very much, Jane. Since making our 5-year commitment in 2005, the International Rescue Committee has been providing essential services to hundreds of thousands of displaced Sudanese people in the various parts of Sudan that have been in conflict, the south, the northeast, and the west, the region known as Darfur. We have had three main foci for our activities. The first is to bring clean water and sanitation to populations that have been unrooted from their homes. The second is to focus on health. We provide primary health care in our clinics, and we also train traditional birth attendants and community health workers, hundreds of them, especially in southern Sudan, but also in other parts of Sudan. The third of our foci is education. In the populations that have been most immediately disrupted, we have informal educational programs, usually including recreation. We also have educational programs that are more formal, so reading, writing, arithmetic, and a semi-classroom setting. And finally, we provide vocational education for people so that they can get back on their feet once they're able to get back home. Life is certainly difficult for most people in Sudan, and we're working hard every day to make it just a little bit better and to give hope to the people of Sudan for the future. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much. Let me just take one quick moment before we applaud this extraordinary panel to first applaud all of you for the quality of the questions and the themes that you're bringing up to these panelists. It makes their job so much easier and so much more fun. But I also want to thank the table facilitators, because every table has got a facilitator who's working really hard. They're having a lot of fun, too, but they're doing a magnificent job of getting this information to us quickly. So thank you, all of you. Now, I just have two requests of you. The first is that you send emails to the New York Times saying that despite everything that's been said about Nick Kristof, he's actually a good guy. And the second thing is that you do note at the end of it that he doesn't have to reply to that email so that we can get the balance back in. But please join me in applauding the full panel and Nick for his leadership.